Inside, Annie hastily took my cloak and returned to the fire, where she had been stooped over something on the hearth.
"Have a care, Annie,"
Susanna said, sounding harassed. Annie was carefully lifting a shallow saucepan from a metal stand set over the embers of the fire.
"Widow Hackett's daughter requires that draught to help her sleep, and the ingredients are costly."
"I can't figure her out, Mama," Jeffrey said, looking at me. His eyes were disconcertingly wise for one so young.
"Nor I, Jeffrey, nor I. But that's probably why she's here. Take your brother into the other room, and be quiet. Your father is sleeping and he needs to remain so."
"Yes, Mama." Jeffrey scooped up two wooden soldiers and a ship from the table. "This time I'll let you be Walter Raleigh so you can win the battle," he promised his brother. Susanna and Annie stared at me in the silence that followed. Annie's faint pulses of power were already familiar, but I wasn't prepared for the steady current of inquiry that Susanna turned my way. My third eye opened. Finally, someone had roused my witch's curiosity. "That's uncomfortable," I said, turning my head to break the intensity of Susanna's gaze.
"It should be," she said calmly. "Why do you require my help, mistress?"
I was spellbound. "It's not what you think," I said when Annie took an immediate step away from me. Both of my parents were witches, but neither one understood the nature of my talents. They didn't want me to come to any harm, so they bound me. The bindings have loosened, however, and strange things are happening.
"Such as?"
Susanna said, pointing Annie to a chair. "I've summoned witch water a few times, though not recently. Sometimes I see colors surrounding people, but not always. And I touched a quince and it shriveled." I was careful not to mention my more spectacular outbreaks of magic. Nor did I mention the odd threads of blue and amber in the corners, or the way handwriting had started to escape from Matthew's books and reptiles flee from Mary Sidney's shoes.
"Was your mother or father a water witch?"
Susanna asked, trying to make sense of my story. "I don't know," I said honestly. "They died when I was young."
"Perhaps you are better suited to the craft, then. Though many wish to possess the rough magics of water and fire, they're not easy to come by,"
said Susanna with a touch of pity. My Aunt Sarah thought witches who relied on elemental magic were dilettantes. Susanna, on the other hand, was inclined to see spells as a lesser form of magical knowledge. I smothered a sigh at these bizarre prejudices. Weren't we all witches? My aunt wasn't able to teach me many spells. Sometimes I can light a candle. I have been able to call objects to me.
"But you are a grown woman,"
Susanna said, her hand settling on her hips.
"Even Annie has more skills than that, and she is but 14. Can you concoct philtres from plants?"
"No." Sarah had wanted me to learn how to make potions, but I had declined.
"Are you a healer?"
"No." I was beginning to understand Annie's browbeaten expression. Susanna sighed.
"Why Andrew Hubbard requires my assistance, I do not know. I have quite enough to do with my patients, an infirm husband and two growing sons."
She took a chipped bowl from the shelf and a brown egg from a rack by the window. She placed both on the table before me and pulled out a chair.
"Sit, and tuck your hands beneath your legs."
Mystified, I did as she requested.
"Annie and I are going to Widow Hackett's house. While we're gone, you are to get the contents of that egg into the bowl without using your hands. It requires two spells, a motion spell and a simple opening charm. My son John is 8, and he can already do it without thinking." "But if the egg isn't in the bowl when I return, no one can help you, Mistress Royden. Your parents may have been right to bind you if your power is so weak that you cannot even crack an egg."
Annie gave me an apologetic look as she lifted the pan into her arms. Susanna clapped a lid on it.
"Come, Annie."
Sitting alone in the Normans' gathering room, I considered the egg and the bowl. "What a nightmare," I whispered, hoping the boys were too far away to hear. I took a deep breath and gathered my energy. I knew the words to both spells, and I wanted the egg to move, wanted it badly. Magic was nothing more than desire made real, I reminded myself. I focused my desires on the egg. It hopped on the table once, then subsided. Silently, I repeated the spell. And again. And again. Minutes later, the only result of my efforts was a thin skim of perspiration on my forehead. All I had to do was lift the egg and crack it, and I had failed. Sorry, I murmured to my flat stomach. With any luck, you'll take after your father. My stomach flopped over. Nerves and rapidly changing hormones were hell on the digestion. Did chickens get morning sickness? I tilted my head and looked at the egg. Some poor hen had been robbed of her unhatched chick to feed the Norman family. My nausea increased. Perhaps I should consider vegetarianism, at least during the pregnancy. But maybe there was no chick at all, I comforted myself. Not every egg was fertilized. My third eye peered under the surface of the shell, through the thickening layers of albumin to the yolk. Traces of life ran in thin streaks of red across the yolk's surface. Fertile, I said with a sigh. I shifted on my hands. Em and Sarah had kept hens for a while. It took a hen only 3 weeks to hatch an egg. 3 weeks of warmth and care, and there was a baby chicken. It didn't seem fair that I had to wait months before our child saw the light of day. Care and warmth. Such simple things, yet they ensured life. What had Matthew said? All that children need is love, a grown-up to take responsibility for them, and a soft place to land. The same was true for chicks. I imagined what it would feel like to be surrounded in a mother hen's feathery warmth, safely cocooned from bumps and bruises. Would our child feel like that, floating in the depths of my womb? If not, was there a spell for it? One woven from responsibility that would wrap the baby in care and warmth and love, yet be gentle enough to give him both safety and freedom? That's my real desire, I whispered.
Peep.
I looked around. Many households had a few chickens pecking around the hearth.
Peep.
It was coming from the egg on the table. There was a crack, then a beak. A bewildered set of black eyes blinked at me from a feathered head slicked down with moisture. Someone behind me gasped. I turned. Annie's hand was clapped over her mouth, and she was staring at the chick on the table.
Aunt Susanna, Annie said, dropping her hand. Is that?
She trailed off and pointed wordlessly at me.
Yes. That's the glam left over from Mistress Royden's new spell. Go, fetch Goody Allsop.
Susanna spun her niece around and sent her back the way she came. I didn't get the egg into the bowl, Mistress Norman, I apologized. The spells didn't work. The still wet chick set up a protest, one indignant peep after another.
Didn't work? I'm beginning to think you know nothing about being a witch, said Susanna incredulously.
I was beginning to think she was right. Chapter 20. Phoebe found the quiet at Sotheby's Bond Street offices unsettling this Tuesday night. Though she'd been working at the London auction house for 2 weeks, she was still not accustomed to the building. Every sound, the buzzing of the overhead lights, the security guard pulling on the doors to make sure they were locked, the distant sound of recorded laughter on a television, made her jump. As the junior person in the department, it had fallen on Phoebe to wait behind a locked door for Dr. Whitmore to arrive. Sylvia, her supervisor, had been adamant that someone needed to see the man after hours. Phoebe suspected that this request was highly irregular, but was too new in the job to make more than a weak protest.
"Of course you will stay. He will be here by 7 o'clock, Sylvia had said smoothly, fingering her strand of pearls before picking up her ballet tickets from the desk. "Besides, you don't have anywhere else to be, do you?"
Sylvia was right. Phoebe had nowhere else to be.
But who is he? Phoebe asked. It was a perfectly legitimate question, but Sylvia had looked affronted. He's from Oxford and an important client of this firm. That's all you need to know, Sylvia replied. Sotheby's values confidentiality, or did you miss that part of your training?
And so Phoebe was still at her desk. She waited well beyond the promised hour of 7. To pass the time, she went through the files to find out more about the man. She didn't like meeting people without knowing as much about their background as possible. Sylvia might think all she needed was his name and a vague sense of his credentials, but Phoebe knew different. Her mother had taught her what a valuable weapon such personal information could be when wielded against guests at cocktail parties and formal dinners. Phoebe hadn't been able to find any Whitmores in the Sotheby's archives, however, and his customer number led to a simple card in a locked file cabinet that said, "De Clermont Family, inquire with the president." At 9:05, she heard someone outside the door. The man's voice was gruff, yet strangely musical.
"This is the third wild goose chase you've sent me on in as many days, Isabeau. Please try to remember that I have things to do. Send a land next time."
There was a brief pause.
"You think I'm not busy? I'll call you after I see them."
The man made a muffled oath.
"Tell your intuition to take a break, for God's sake."
The man sounded strange. Half American and half British, but with blurred edges to his accent, suggesting that these weren't the only languages he knew. Phoebe's father had been in the Queen's diplomatic service, and his voice was similarly ambiguous, as though he hailed from everywhere and nowhere. The bell rang, another shrill sound that made her flinch, despite the fact that Phoebe was expecting it. She pushed away from her desk and strode across the room. She was wearing her black heels, which had cost a fortune but made her look taller, and, Phoebe told herself, more authoritative. It was a trick she'd learned from Sylvia at her first interview, when she had worn flats. Afterward, she'd vowed never to appear adorably petite again. She looked through the peephole to see a smooth forehead, scruffy blonde hair, and a pair of brilliant blue eyes. Surely this wasn't Dr. Whitmore. A sudden rap on the door startled her. Whoever this man was, he had no manners. Irritated, Phoebe punched the button on the intercom.
"Yes," she said impatiently.
"Marcus Whitmore here to see Miss Thorpe."
Phoebe looked through the peephole once more. Impossible. No one this young would warrant Sylvia's attention.
"Might I see some identification?" she said crisply.
"Where is Sylvia?"
The blue eyes narrowed.
"At the ballet. Coppelia, I believe."
Sylvia's tickets were the best in the house. The extravagance claimed as a business expense. The man on the other side of the door slapped an identification card flat against the peephole. Phoebe reared back.
"If you would be so kind as to step away. I can't see anything at that distance."
The card moved a few inches from the door.
"Really, Miss..."
"Taylor."
"Miss Taylor, I am in a hurry."
The card disappeared, replaced by those twin blue beacons. Phoebe drew back again in surprise, but not before she'd made out the name on the card and his affiliation with the scientific research project in Oxford. It was Dr. Whitmore. What business did a scientist have with Sotheby's? Phoebe pushed the release for the door. As soon as the click sounded, Whitmore pushed his way through. He was dressed for a club in Soho, with his black jeans, vintage gray U2 t-shirt, and a ridiculous pair of high-top Converse trainers, also gray. A leather cord circled his neck, and a handful of ornaments of dubious provenance and little worth hung down from it. Phoebe straightened the hem of her impeccably clean white blouse and looked at him with annoyance.
"Thank you,"
Whitmore said, standing far closer to her than was normal in polite society.
"Sylvia left a package for me."
"If you would be seated, Dr. Whitmore."
She gestured to the chair in front of her desk. Whitmore's blue eyes moved from the chair to her.
"Must I? This won't take long." I'm only here to confirm that my grandmother isn't seeing zebras where there are only horses.
Excuse me? Phoebe inched toward her desk. There was a security alarm under the desk's surface next to the drawer. If the man continued to misbehave, she would use it. The package? Whitmore kept his gaze directed at her. There was a spark of interest there. Phoebe recognized it and crossed her arms in an effort to deflect it. He pointed to the padded box on the desk without looking at it.
I'm guessing that's it?
Please sit down, Dr. Whitmore. It's long past closing time, I'm tired, and there is paperwork to be filled out before I can let you examine whatever it is that Sylvia set aside. Phoebe reached up and rubbed at the back of her neck. It was cricked from looking up at him. Whitmore's nostrils flared and his eyelids drifted down. Phoebe noticed that his eyelashes were darker than his blonde hair, and longer and thicker than hers. Any woman would kill for lashes like those.
I really think you had better give me the box and let me be on my way, Miss Taylor.
The gruff voice smoothed out, deepened into a warning, though Phoebe couldn't understand why. What was he going to do, steal the box? Again she considered sounding the alarm, but thought better of it. Sylvia would be furious if she offended a client by calling the guards. Instead, Phoebe stepped to the desk, picked up a paper and pen, and returned to thrust them at the visitor.
Fine. I'm happy to do this standing up if you prefer, Dr. Whitmore, though it's a great deal less comfortable.
That's the best offer I've had in some time.
Whitmore's mouth twitched.
If we're going to proceed according to Hoyle, though, I think you should call me Marcus.
Hoyle?
Phoebe flushed and drew herself up to her full height. Whitmore wasn't taking her seriously.
I don't think he works here.
I certainly hope not.
He scrawled a signature. Edmund Hoyle's been dead since 1769.
I'm fairly new at Sotheby's. You'll have to forgive me for not understanding the reference.
Phoebe sniffed. Once again, she was too far from the hidden button underneath her desk to use it. Whitmore might not be a thief, but she was beginning to think he was mad.
Here's your pen, Marcus said politely, and your form. See?
He leaned closer.
I did exactly what you asked me to. I'm really very well behaved. My father made sure of it.
Phoebe took the pen and paper from him. As she did, her fingers brushed against the back of Whitmore's hand. Its coldness made her shiver. There was a heavy gold signet on his pinky finger, she noticed. It looked medieval, but no one walked around London with such a rare and valuable ring on his finger. It must be a fake, though a good one. She inspected the form as she returned to the desk. It all seemed to be in order, and if this man turned out to be some kind of criminal, which wouldn't surprise her a bit, at least she wouldn't be guilty of breaking the rules. Phoebe lifted the lid of the box, prepared to surrender it to the odd Dr. Whitmore for his examination. She hoped that then she could go home.
Oh!
Her voice caught in surprise. She'd expected to see a fabulous diamond necklace or a Victorian set of emeralds in fussy gold filigree, something her own grandmother would like. Instead, the box contained two oval miniatures, set into niches that had been formed to adhere perfectly to their edges and protect them from damage. One was of a woman with long golden hair tinged with red. An open-necked ruff framed her heart-shaped face. Her pale eyes looked out at the viewer with calm assurance, and her mouth curved in a gentle smile. The background was the vivid blue common to the work of the Elizabethan limner Nicholas Hilliard. The other miniature depicted a man with a shock of black hair brushed back from his forehead. A straggling beard and mustache made him look younger than his black eyes suggested, and his white linen shirt was also open at the neck, showing flesh that was milkier than the cloth. Long fingers held a jewel suspended from a thick chain. Behind the man, golden flames burned and twisted, a symbol of passion. A soft breath tickled her ear.
Holy Christ!
Whitmore looked like he'd seen a ghost.
They're beautiful, aren't they? This must be the set of miniatures that just arrived.
An old couple in Shropshire found them hidden in the back of their silver chest when they were looking for a place to store some new pieces. Sylvia reckons they'll fetch a good price.
Oh, there's no doubt about that.
Marcus pushed a button on his phone.
Oui,
said an imperious French voice at the other end of the line.
This was the problem with cell phones, Phoebe thought. Everybody shouted on them, and you could hear private conversations.
You were right about the miniatures, Grand-mère.
A self-satisfied sound drifted out of the phone.
Do I have your complete attention now, Marcus?
No, and thank God for it. My complete attention isn't good for anybody.
Whitmore eyed Phoebe and smiled. The man was charming, Phoebe reluctantly admitted.
But give me a few days before you send me on another errand. Just how much are you willing to pay for them, or shouldn't I ask?
N'importe quel prix.
The price doesn't matter. These were words that made auction houses happy. Phoebe stared down at the miniatures. They really were extraordinary. Whitmore and his grandmother concluded their conversation, and the man's fingers immediately flew across his phone, transmitting another message.
Hilliard believed that his portrait miniatures were best viewed in private, Phoebe mused aloud. He felt that the art of limning put too many of his subjects' secrets on display. You can see why. These two looked like they kept all kinds of secrets.
You're right there, Marcus murmured.
His face was very close, giving Phoebe an opportunity to examine his eyes more closely. They were bluer than she had first realized, bluer than even the azurite and ultramarine-enriched pigments Hilliard used. The phone rang. When Phoebe reached to answer it, she thought his hand drifted down, just for a moment, to her waist.
Give the man his miniatures, Phoebe.
It was Sylvia.
I don't understand, she said numbly.
I'm not authorized. He's purchased them outright. Our obligation was to get the highest possible price for their pieces. We've done that. The taverners will be able to spend their autumn years in Monte Carlo if they choose. And you can tell Marcus that if I've missed the danse de fête, I'll be enjoying his family's box seats for next season's performances.
Sylvia disconnected the line. The room was silent. Marcus Whitmore's finger rested gently on the gold case that circled the miniature of the man. It looked like a gesture of longing, an attempt to connect to someone long dead and anonymous.
I almost believe that, were I to speak, he might hear me, Marcus said wistfully.
Something was off. Phoebe couldn't identify what it was, but there was more at stake here than the acquisition of 2 16th-century miniatures.
Your grandmother must have a very healthy bank account, Dr. Whitmore, to pay so handsomely for 2 unidentifiable Elizabethan portraits. As you are also a Sotheby's client, I feel I should tell you that you surely overpaid for them. A portrait of Queen Elizabeth I from this period might go for 6 figures with the right buyers in the room, but not these. The identity of the sitter was crucial to such valuations.
We'll never know who these two were. Not after so many centuries of obscurity. Names are important.
That's what my grandmother says.
Then she is aware that without a definite attribution, the value of these miniatures will probably not increase.
To be honest, Marcus said, my grandmother doesn't need to make a return on her investment, and Isabeau would prefer it if no one else knows who they are.
Phoebe frowned at the odd phrasing. Did his grandmother think she did know?
It's a pleasure doing business with you, Phoebe, even if we did do it standing up, this time.
Marcus paused, smiled his charming smile.
You don't mind my calling you Phoebe?
Phoebe did mind. She rubbed at her neck in exasperation, pushing aside her black, collar-length hair. Marcus's eyes lingered on the curve of her shoulders. When she made no reply, he closed the box, tucked the miniatures under his arm, and backed away.
I'd like to take you to dinner, he said mildly, seemingly unaware of Phoebe's clear signals of uninterest. We can celebrate the taverner's good fortune,
as well as the sizable commission that you will be splitting with Sylvia.
Sylvia? Split a commission?
Phoebe's mouth gaped in disbelief. The chances that her boss might do such a thing were less than nil. Marcus's expression darkened.
It was a condition of the deal. My grandmother wouldn't have it any other way. His voice was gruff. Dinner?
I don't go out with strange men after dark.
Then I'll ask you out to dinner tomorrow, after we've had lunch. Once you've spent 2 hours in my company, I won't be strange any longer.
Oh, you'll still be strange, Phoebe muttered. And I don't take lunch. I eat at my desk.
She looked away in confusion. Had she said the first part aloud?
I'll pick you up at 1, said Marcus, his smile widening.
Phoebe's heart sank. She had said it aloud.
And don't worry, we won't go far.
Why not?
Did he think she was afraid of him or couldn't keep up with his strides? God, she hated being short.
I just wanted you to know that you could wear those shoes again without fearing you'd break your neck, Marcus said innocently.
His eyes traveled slowly from her toes over her black leather pumps, lingered on her ankles, and then crawled up the curve of her calf.
I like them.
Who did this man think he was? He was behaving like an 18th-century rake.
Phoebe took decisive steps toward the door, her heels making satisfyingly sharp clicks.
She pushed the button to release the lock and held the door open. Marcus made an appreciative sound as he strolled toward her.
I shouldn't be so forward. My grandmother disapproves of that almost as much as she disapproves of being cut out of a business deal. But here's the thing, Phoebe.
Whitmore lowered his mouth until it was inches from her ear and dropped his voice to a whisper. Unlike the men who have taken you out to dinner and perhaps gone back to your flat for something afterward, your propriety and fine manners don't frighten me off. Quite the contrary. And I can't help imagining what you're like when that icy control melts.
Phoebe gasped.
Marcus took her hand, his lips pressed against her flesh as he stared into her eyes.
Until tomorrow.
And make sure the door locks behind me. You're in enough trouble. Dr. Whitmore walked backward out of the room, gave her another bright smile, turned, and whistled his way out of sight.
Phoebe's hand was trembling. That man, that strange man with no grasp of proper etiquette and startling blue eyes, had kissed her, at her place of work, without her permission.
And she hadn't slapped him, which is what well-bred daughters of diplomats were taught to do as a last resort against unwanted advances at home and abroad. She was indeed in trouble.
Chapter 21
Was I right to call you, Goody Allsop?
Susanna twisted her hands in her apron and looked at me anxiously.
I nearly sent her home, she said weakly. If I had...
But you didn't, Susanna.
Goody Allsop was so old and thin that her skin clung to the bones of her hands and wrists. The witch's voice was strangely hearty for someone so frail, however, and intelligence snapped in her eyes. The woman might be an octogenarian, but no one would dare call her infirm. Now that Goody Allsop had arrived, the main room in the Norman apartments was full to bursting. With some reluctance, Susanna allowed Matthew and Pierre to stand just inside the door, provided they didn't touch anything. Geoffrey and John divided their attention between the vampires and the chick, now safely nestled inside John's cap by the fire. Its feathers were beginning to fluff in the warm air, and it had, mercifully, stopped peeping. I sat on a stool by the fire next to Goody Allsop, who occupied the room's only chair.
"Let me have a look at you, Diana."
When Goody Allsop reached her fingers toward my face, just as Widow Beaton and Champierre had, I flinched. The witch stopped and frowned.
"What is it, child?"
A witch in France tried to read my skin. It felt like knives, I explained in a whisper.
"It will not be entirely comfortable. What examination is? but it should not hurt.
Her fingers explored my features. Her hands were cool and dry, the veins standing out against mottled skin and crawling over bent joints. I felt a slight digging sensation, but it was nothing like the pain I'd experienced at Champier's hands.
Ah, she breathed when she had reached the smooth skin of my forehead.
My witch's eye, which had lapsed into its typical frustrating inactivity the moment Susanna and Annie found me with the chick, opened fully. Goody Alsop was a witch worth knowing. Looking into Goody Alsop's third eye, I was plunged into a world of color. Try as I might, the brightly woven threads refused to resolve into something recognizable, though I felt once more the tantalizing prospect that they could be put to some use. Goody Alsop's touch tingled as she probed my body and mind with her second sight, energy pulsing around her in a purple-tinged orange. In my limited experience, no one had ever manifested that particular combination of colors. She tutted here and there, made an approving sound or two.
"She's a strange one, isn't she?" Geoffrey whispered, peering over Goody Alsop's shoulder.
"Geoffrey?"
Susanna gasped, embarrassed at her son's behavior.
"Mistress Royden, if you please."
"Very well. Mistress Royden's a strange one," said Geoffrey, unrepentant.
He shifted his hands to his knees and bent closer.
"What do you see, young Geoffrey?"
Goody Alsop asked.
"She, Mistress Royden, is all the colors of a rainbow. Her witch's eye is blue, even though the rest of her is green and silver like the goddess. And why is there a rim of red and black there?"
Geoffrey pointed to my forehead.
"That's a wers mark," Goody Alsop said, smoothing it with her fingers. "It tells us she belongs to Master Royden's family. Whenever you see this, Geoffrey, and it is quite rare, you must heed it as a warning. The werch who made it will not take kindly if you meddle with the warm blood he has claimed."
"Does it hurt?" the child wondered.
"Geoffrey!"
Susanna cried again.
"You know better than to pester Goody Alsop with questions."
"We face a dark future if children stop asking questions, Susanna,"
Goody Alsop remarked.
"A werch's blood can heal, but it doesn't harm," I told the boy before Goody Alsop could answer.
There was no need for another witch to grow up fearing what he didn't understand. My eyes shifted to Matthew, whose claim on me went far deeper than his father's blood oath. Matthew was willing to let Goody Alsop's examination continue, for now, but his eyes never left the woman. I mustered a smile, and his mouth tightened a fraction in response.
"Ooh!"
Geoffrey sounded mildly interested at this piece of intelligence.
"Can you make the glam again, Mistress Royden?"
To their chagrin, the boys had missed that manifestation of magical energy. Goody Alsop rested a gnarled finger in the indentation over Geoffrey's lip, effectively silencing the boy.
"I need to talk to Annie now. After we're through, Master Royden's man is going to take all three of you to the river. When you get back, you can ask me whatever you'd like."
Matthew inclined his head toward the door, and Pierre rounded up his two young charges and, after a wary look at the old woman, took them downstairs to wait. Like Geoffrey, Pierre needed to overcome his fear of other creatures.
"Where is the girl?"
Goody Alsop asked, turning her head. Annie crept forward.
"Here, Goody."
"Tell us true, Annie,"
Goody Alsop said in a firm tone.
"What have you promised Andrew Hubbard?"
Nothing,
Annie stammered, her eyes shifting to mine.
"Don't lie, Annie. 'Tis a sin," Goody Alsop chided. "Out with it."
"I'm to send word if Master Royden plans to leave London again. And Father Hubbard sends one of his men when the mistress and master are still abed to question me about what goes on in the house."
Annie's words tumbled out. When through, she clapped her hands over her mouth as though she couldn't believe she'd revealed so much.
"We must abide by the letter of Annie's agreement with Hubbard, if not its spirit."
Goody Alsop thought for a moment.
"If Mistress Royden leaves the city for any reason, Annie will send word to me first. Wait an hour before you let Hubbard know, Annie. and if you speak a word to anyone of what happens here, I'll clap a binding spell on your tongue that 13 witches won't be able to break."
Annie looked justifiably terrified at the prospect.
"Go and join the boys, but open all the doors and windows before you leave. I will send for you when it's time to return."
Annie's expression while she opened the shutters and doors was full of apology and dread, and I gave her an encouraging nod. The poor child was in no position to stand up to Hubbard, and had done what she had to in order to survive. With one more frightened look at Matthew, whose attitude toward her was distinctly chilly, she left. At last, the house quiet and drafts swirling around my ankles and shoulders, Matthew spoke. He was still propped up against the door, his black clothes absorbing what little light there was in the room.
"Can you help us, Goody Allsop?"
His courteous tone bore no resemblance to his high-handed treatment of Widow Beaton.
"I believe so, Master Royden," Goody Allsop replied.
"Please take your ease," Susanna said, gesturing Matthew toward a nearby stool.
There was, alas, little chance of a man of Matthew's size being comfortable on a small three-legged stool, but he straddled it without complaint.
"My husband is sleeping in the next room. He mustn't overhear the wech or our conversation."
Goody Allsop plucked at the gray wool and pearly linen that covered her neck and drew her fingers away, pulling something insubstantial with them. The witch stretched out her hand and flicked her wrist, releasing a shadowy figure into the room. Her exact replica walked off into Susanna's bedchamber. "What was that?" I asked, hardly daring to breathe.
"My fetch. She will watch over Master Norman and make sure we're not disturbed."
Goody Allsop's lips moved and the drafts stopped.
"Now that the doors and windows are sealed, we will not be overheard either. You can rest easy on that score, Susanna."
Here were two spells that might prove useful in a spy's household. I opened my mouth to ask Goody Allsop how she'd managed them, but before I could utter a word, she held up her hand and chuckled.
"You are very curious for a grown woman. I fear you'll try Susanna's patience even more than Geoffrey does."
She sat back and regarded me with a pleased expression.
"I have waited a long time for you, Diana."
"Me?" I said doubtfully.
"Without question. It has been many years since the first auguries foretold your arrival, and with the passing of time, some among us gave up hope. But when our sisters told us of the portents in the north, I knew to expect you."
Goody Allsop was referring to Beric and the strange occurrences in Scotland. I sat forward, ready to question her further, but Matthew shook his head slightly. He still wasn't sure the witch could be trusted. Goody Allsop saw my husband's silent request and chuckled again.
"So I was right, then," Susanna said, relieved.
"Yes, child. Diana is indeed a weaver."
Goody Allsop's words reverberated in the room, potent as any spell. "What's that?" I whispered.
"There is much we don't understand about our present situation, Goody Allsop."
Matthew took my hand.
"Perhaps you should treat us both like Geoffrey and explain it as you would to a child."
"Diana is a maker of spells," Goody Allsop said. "We weavers are rare creatures. That is why the goddess sent you to me."
"No, Goody Allsop, you're mistaken," I protested with a shake of my head. "I'm terrible with spells. My Aunt Sarah has great skill, but not even she has been able to teach me the craft of the witch."
"Of course you cannot perform the spells of other witches. You must devise your own."
Goody Allsop's pronouncement went against everything I'd been taught. I looked at her in amazement.
"Witches learn spells. We don't invent them."
Spells were passed from generation to generation, within families and among coven members. We jealously guarded that knowledge, recording words and procedures in grimoires along with the names of the witches who mastered their accompanying magic. More experienced witches trained the younger members of the coven to follow in their footsteps, mindful of the nuances of each spell and every witch's past experience with it.
Weavers do, Goody Allsop replied.
I've never heard of a weaver, Matthew said carefully.
Few have. We are a secret, Master Royden. One that few witches discover, let alone werchs. You are familiar with secrets and how to keep them, I think.
Her eyes twinkled with mischief. I have lived many years, Goody Allsop. I find it hard to believe that witches could keep the existence of weavers from other creatures all that time. He scowled. Is this another of Hubbard's games?
I am too old for games, Monsieur de Clermont. Oh, yes, I know who you really are and what position you occupy in our world, Goody Allsop said when Matthew looked surprised. Perhaps you cannot hide the truth from witches as well as you think.
Perhaps not, Matthew purred in warning. His growling further amused the old woman.
That trick might frighten children like Geoffrey and John and moon-touched demons like your friend Christopher, but it does not scare me.
Her voice turned serious.
Weavers hide because once we were sought out and murdered, just like your father's knights. Not everyone approved of our power. As you well know, it can be easier to survive when your enemies think you are already dead.
But who would do such a thing? And why? I hoped that the answer wouldn't lead us back to the long-standing enmity between vampires and witches.
It wasn't the werchs or the demons who hunted us down, but other witches, Goody Allsop said calmly. They fear us because we are different. Fear breeds contempt, then hate. It is a familiar story. Once, witches destroyed whole families lest the babes grew to be weavers, too. The few weavers who survived sent their own children into hiding. A parent's love for a child is powerful, as you will both soon discover.
You know about the baby, I said, my hands moving protectively over my belly.
Yes.
Goody Allsop nodded gravely.
You are already making a powerful weaving, Diana. You will not be able to keep it hidden from other witches for long.
A child?
Susanna's eyes were huge.
Conceived between a witch and a werch?
Not just any witch. Only weavers can work such magic. There is a reason the goddess chose you for this task, Susanna, just as there is a reason she called me. You are a midwife, and all your skills will be needed in the days ahead.
I have no experience that will help, Mistress Royden, Susanna protested.
You have been assisting women in childbirth for years, Goody Allsop observed.
Warm-blooded women, Goody, with warm-blooded babes, Susanna said indignantly. Not creatures like...
Werchs have arms and legs just like the rest of us, Goody Allsop interrupted. I cannot imagine this child will be any different.
Just because it has 10 fingers and 10 toes does not mean it has a soul, Susanna said, eyeing Matthew with suspicion.
I'm surprised at you, Susanna. Master Royden's soul is as clear to me as your own. Have you been listening to your husband again, and his prattle about the evil in werchs and demons?
Susanna's mouth tightened.
What if I have, Goody?
Then you are a fool. Witches see the truth plainly, even if their husbands are full of nonsense.
It is not such an easy matter as you make it out to be, Susanna muttered.
Nor does it need to be so difficult. The long-awaited weaver is among us, and we must make plans.
Thank you, Goody Allsop, Matthew said. He was relieved that someone agreed with him at last. You're right. Diana must learn what she needs to know quickly. She cannot have the child here.
That isn't entirely your decision, Master Royden. If the child is meant to be born in London, then that is where it will be born.
Diana doesn't belong here, Matthew said, adding quickly, in London.
Bless us, that is clear enough. but as she is a time spinner, merely moving her to another place will not help. Diana would be no less conspicuous in Canterbury or York.
So you know another of our secrets. Matthew gave the old woman a cold stare. As you know so much, you must have also divined that Diana will not be returning to her own time alone. The child and I will be going with her. You will teach her what she needs in order to do it. Matthew was taking charge, which meant that things were about to take their usual turn for the worse.
Your wife's education is my business now, Master Royden, unless you think you know more about what it means to be a weaver than I do, Goody Alsop said mildly.
He knows that this is a matter between witches, I told Goody Alsop, putting a restraining hand on his arm. Matthew won't interfere.
Everything about my wife is my business, Goody Alsop, said Matthew.
He turned to me. And this is not a matter solely between witches. Not if the witches here might turn against my mate and my child.
So it was a witch and not a werch who injured you, Goody Alsop said softly. I felt the pain and knew that a witch was part of it, but hoped that was because the witch was healing the damage done to you rather than causing it. What has the world come to that one witch would do such a thing to another?
Matthew fixed his attention on Goody Alsop. Maybe the witch also realized that Diana was a weaver. It hadn't occurred to me that Satu might have known. Given what Goody Alsop had told me about my fellow witches' attitudes toward weavers, the idea that Peter Knox and his cronies in the congregation might suspect me of harboring such a secret sent my blood racing. Matthew sought my hand, taking it between both of his.
It is possible, but I cannot say for certain, Goody Alsop told us regretfully. Nevertheless, we must do what we can in the time the goddess provides to prepare Diana for her future.
Stop, I said, slapping my palm on the table. Isabeau's ring chimed against the hardwood. You're all talking as though this weaving business makes sense, but I can't even light a candle. My talents are magical. I have wind, water, even fire in my blood.
If I can see your husband's soul, Diana, you will not be surprised that I have also seen your power. But you are not a fire witch or a water witch, no matter what you believe. You cannot command these elements. If you were foolish enough to attempt it, you would be destroyed.
But I nearly drowned in my own tears, I said stubbornly. And to save Matthew, I killed a werch with an arrow of witchfire. My aunt recognized the smell.
A fire witch has no need of arrows. The fire leaves her and arrives at its target in an instant.
Goody Alsop shook her head.
These were but simple weavings, my child, fashioned from grief and love. The goddess has given you her blessing to borrow the powers you need, but not to command any of them absolutely.
Borrow them. I thought over the frustrating events of the past months and the glimmers of magic that would never behave as they were supposed to do. So that's why these abilities come and go. They were never really mine.
No witch could hold so much power within her without upsetting the balance of the worlds. A weaver selects carefully from the magic around her and uses it to shape something new.
But there must be thousands of spells in existence, not to mention charms and potions. Nothing I make could possibly be original. I drew my hand across my forehead, and the spot where Philippe had made his blood oath seemed cold to the touch.
All spells came from somewhere, Diana. A moment of need, a longing, a challenge that could not be met any other way. And they came from someone, too.
The first witch, I whispered. Some creatures believed that Ashmole 782 was the first grimoire, a book that contained the original enchantments and charms devised by our people. Here was another connection between me and the mysterious manuscript. I looked at Matthew.
The first weaver, Goody Alsop corrected gently, as well as those who followed. Weavers are not simply witches, Diana. Susanna is a great witch, with more knowledge about the magic of the earth and its lore than any of her sisters in London. For all her gifts, though, she cannot weave a new spell. You can.
I can't even imagine how to begin, I said.
You hatched that chick,
Goody Allsup said, pointing to the sleepy yellow ball of fluff.
But I was trying to crack an egg, I protested.
Now that I understood marksmanship, I was aware this was a problem. My magic, like my arrows, had missed its target.
Obviously not. If you were trying simply to crack an egg, we would be enjoying some of Susanna's excellent custard. You had something else in mind.
The chick concurred, emitting a particularly loud and clear peep. She was right. I had indeed had other things on my mind. Our child, whether we could nurture him properly, how we might keep him safe. Goody Allsup nodded.
I thought so.
I spoke no words, performed no ritual, concocted nothing. I was clinging to what Sarah had taught me about the craft. All I did was ask some questions. They weren't even particularly good questions.
Magic begins with desire. The words come much, much later, Goody Allsup explained. Even then, a weaver cannot always reduce a spell to a few lines for another witch to use. Some weavings resist, no matter how hard we try. They are for our use alone. It is why we are feared.
It begins with absence and desire, I murmured. Past and present clashed again as I repeated the first line of the verse that had accompanied the single page of Ashmole 782 someone once sent to my parents. On this occasion, when the corners lit up and illuminated the dust motes in shades of blue and gold, I didn't look away. Neither did Goody Allsup. Matthew's and Susanna's eyes followed ours, but neither saw anything out of the ordinary.
Exactly. See there how time feels your absence and wants you back to weave yourself into your former life.
She beamed, clapping her hands together as though I'd made her a particularly fine crayon drawing of a house and she planned to display it on her refrigerator door.
Of course, time is not ready for you now. If it were, the blue would be much brighter.
You make it sound as though it's possible to combine magic and the craft, but they're separate, I said, still confused. Witchcraft uses spells, and magic is an inherited power over an element like air or fire.
Who taught you such nonsense? Goody Allsup snorted, and Susanna looked appalled. Magic and witchcraft are but two paths that cross in the wood. A weaver is able to stand at the crossroads with one foot placed on each path. She can occupy the place between, where the powers are the greatest.
Time protested this revelation with a loud cry. A child between, a witch apart, I murmured in wonder. The ghost of Bridget Bishop had warned me of the dangers associated with such a vulnerable position. Before we came here, the ghost of one of my ancestors, Bridget Bishop, told me that was my fate. She must have known I was a weaver.
So did your parents, Goody Allsup said. I can see the last remaining threads of their binding. Your father was a weaver, too. He knew you would follow his path.
Her father? Matthew asked.
Weavers are seldom men, Goody Allsup, Susanna cautioned.
Diana's father was a weaver of great talent but no training. His spell was pieced together rather than properly woven. Still, it was made with love and served its purpose for a time, rather like the chain that binds you to your work, Diana.
The chain was my secret weapon, providing the comforting sensation that I was anchored to Matthew in my darkest moments. Bridget told me something else that same night. There is no path forward that does not have him in it. She must have known about Matthew, too, I confessed.
You never told me about this conversation, mon coeur, Matthew said, sounding more curious than annoyed.
Crossroads and paths and vague prophecies didn't seem important then. With everything that happened afterward, I forgot. I looked at Goody Allsup.
Besides, how could I have been making spells without knowing it?
Weavers are surrounded by mystery, Goody Allsop told me. We haven't the time to seek answers to all your questions now, but must focus instead on teaching you to manage the magic as it moves through you.
My powers have been misbehaving, I admitted, thinking of the shriveled quinces and Mary's ruined shoes. I never know what's going to happen next.
That's not unusual for a weaver first coming into her power. But your brightness can be seen and felt, even by humans.
Goody Allsop sat back in her chair and studied me.
If witches see your glam like young Annie did, they might use the knowledge for their own purposes. We will not let you or the child fall into Hubbard's clutches. I trust you can manage the congregation, she said, looking at Matthew.
Goody Allsop construed Matthew's silence as consent.
Very well, then. Come to me on Mondays and Thursdays, Diana. Mistress Norman will see you on Tuesdays. I shall send for Marjorie Cooper on Wednesdays, and Elizabeth Jackson and Catherine Streeter on Fridays. Diana will need their help to reconcile the fire and water in her blood, or she will never produce more than a vapor.
Perhaps it is not wise to make all those witches privy to this particular secret, Goody, Matthew said.
Master Royden is right. There are already too many whispers about the witch. John Chandler has been spreading news of her to ingratiate himself with Father Hubbard. Surely we can teach her ourselves, said Susanna.
And when did you become a fire witch? Goody Allsop retorted. The child's blood is full of flame. My talents are dominated by witch wind, and yours are grounded in the earth's power. We are not sufficient to the task.
Our gathering will draw too much attention if we proceed with your plan. We are but 13 witches, yet you propose to involve 5 of us in this business. Let some other gathering take on the problem of Mistress Royden. The one in Moorgate, perhaps, or Aldgate.
The Aldgate gathering has grown too large, Susanna. It cannot govern its own affairs, never mind take on the education of a weaver. Besides, it is too far for me to travel, and the bad air by the city ditch worsens my rheumatism. We will train her in this parish as the goddess intended.
I cannot,
Susanna began.
I am your elder, Susanna. If you wish to protest further, you will need to seek a ruling from the reed.
The air thickened uncomfortably.
Very well, Goody. I will send my request to Queen Hythe.
Susanna seemed startled by her own announcement.
Who is Queen Hythe?
I asked Matthew, my voice low. Queen Hythe is a place, not a person, he murmured. But what is this about a reed?
I have no idea, I confessed.
Stop whispering, Goody Allsop said, shaking her head in annoyance. With the charm on the windows and the doors, your muttering stirs the air and hurts my ears.
Once the air quieted, Goody Allsop continued.
Susanna has challenged my authority in this matter. As I am the leader of the Garlic Hythe gathering, and the Vintry's ward elder as well, Mistress Norman must present her case to the other ward elders in London. They will decide on our course of action, as they do whenever there are disagreements between witches. There are 26 elders, and together we are known as the Reed.
So this is just politics, I said.
Politics and prudence. Without a way to settle our own disputes, Father Hubbard would have his wech fingers in even more of our affairs, said Goody Allsop. I am sorry if I offended you, Master Royden.
No offence taken, Goody Allsop. But if you take this matter to your elders, Diana's identity will be known across London. Matthew stood. I can't allow that.
Every witch in the city has already heard about your wife. News travels quickly here. No small thanks to your friend Christopher Marlowe.
Goody Allsop said, craning her neck to meet his eyes.
Sit down, Master Royden. My old bones no longer bend that way.
To my surprise, Matthew sat.
The witches of London still don't know you're a weaver, Diana, and that is the important thing, Goody Allsop continued. The reed will have to be told, of course. When other witches hear that you've been called before the elders, they will assume you are being disciplined for your relationship with Master Royden, or that you're being bound in some fashion to keep him from gaining access to your blood and power.